Good morning, everyone. We're going to kick off our breakfast. If you'd like to take a seat. No one tells Mike to sit down. So good morning. My name is Wendy Beecham. I'm a managing principal at Korn Ferry, and we are absolutely thrilled to welcome you to the first inaugural Watermark Lead-On Conference. An amazing, amazing lineup of speakers. I think it's unprecedented to have the quality and just the immense gravitas of the speakers that we're going to be hearing from today. So we hope that you find the day to be inspiring and challenging and informative, and that you make some new connections as part of the process. Our goal with our breakfast this morning is really to welcome you as our valued clients, and to enable you to really have a chance to meet other people that are doing similar work to you, and to really get connected to the ecosystem that is part of Korn Ferry. So we really hope that you enjoy meeting the other people that are going to be experiencing this conference with you today. But before we introduce our guest speaker, I'd like to introduce Doug Maxfield, who is a senior partner at Korn Ferry. He's been with us for many years, and he came from the acquisition of Global Novations with a diversity and inclusion practice. And many of you, I think, probably have worked with Doug in that capacity. So I'd like to turn over to Doug.
Oh, thank you, Wendy. We don't want to be too formal this morning, but first of all, I want to thank everybody that helped out in putting together this conference this morning and bringing this group together. And especially want to recognize Wendy for all the work she's done and everybody else that supported her. So could we have a round of applause? So a few months ago, she came to a group of us in the San Francisco office with the idea of sponsoring this conference. And when we got into more detail about what the conference was all about, it seemed like a complete no-brainer to do it, especially with the opportunity to gather together this group of wonderful women leaders in organizations and our clients. And we wanted to provide the opportunity for us to get together and to either start or continue a dialogue about women in leadership with your organizations and together as a group. So that was one of our first goals with it. The second goal was to continue a dialogue about what it's going to take to address the challenge of women in leadership, especially in technology organizations. Obviously, hot topic right now, but it's a continuing topic, and one that we believe is not going to be addressed by simply a single solution of either recruiting or leadership development by themselves. And the opportunity that we feel like is here for us is that the solution really is going to come from recruiting, from onboarding, from leadership development, from creating a culture of inclusion in organizations, from board and CEO work, from succession management. And we really feel like that's something that we can be in a dialogue about, because we offer things in all of those different areas. As part of your packet today, you have the normal things that were included in the packet, but we also included for you three specific articles that we hope you take the opportunity to read a little bit later on. One is a career playbook for women that includes data about original research from Korn Ferry about what we found in terms of the development of women. And it specifically includes some data about different competencies that men and women bring to the table, and some things to do in order to change culture, in order to increase development opportunities for women. So that's one of the articles. A second article is called the KF4D. It's about the Korn Ferry Four Dimensions of Leadership. And that is our approach based on research about developing the whole person, a more holistic approach. So we hope you take an opportunity to read that as well. And finally, we have an article in there about succession management, really about not just dealing with succession at the top of the organization, but something that is looking at succession throughout the entire organization and how you can structure it. So we feel like, especially on this topic of women in leadership, this is a critical issue, is succession management. So the third purpose for getting everybody together is just to say thank you to you for being our great clients and contacts throughout the ages. We appreciate our relationship with you. We hope you really take the opportunity over the next 8 hours or so to connect with each other, develop relationships. We'll do our best to introduce you to each other. We'll have a lot of opportunity to sit together, here this morning at our luncheon later on this morning, and then at our breakout session in the afternoon. So again, thank you for being here. We appreciate your braving the traffic and travel and ice in other parts of the country to be here. So thanks very much for coming.
So the KF4D article is now available virtually. It didn't arrive in our packaging, so we will make sure and email it to you. So when you get back to your office tomorrow morning, you'll have that in your inbox. So apologies for that. It's always good to be a bit green on things, right, and save the paper. But it's my great pleasure now to introduce a guest speaker today. She is also speaking on a panel later today, but this is a wonderful opportunity for us to have this private time with Gail Sheehy. And Gail, as you know, was the author of a seminal work called Passages, which is, for the Library of Congress, one of the 10 most important works of our time. And I thought that from an inspirational perspective, it's just a great way to kick off this conference, because she's recently written a new work around daring, which continues her life story from the initial Passages work, but really looks at the risks that women have taken and the challenges that they faced and what that led to because of taking those risks. And so we felt that it was just wonderful to have this private time with Gail, have a dialogue with her, and hopefully we'll create an inspirational opening for the conference for you today. So with that, I'd like to introduce Gail Sheehy.
Thank you, Wendy. That was such a nice introduction. Good morning. I am so thrilled to start off the conference with a room full of really accomplished women and men. I mean, you're right at the top. And to have an opportunity for a down-to-earth conversation. I want this to be a dialogue. And I thought it could be about the eternal question that will be the topic of my panel at the 10 o'clock conference, which is, how do we find a healthy balance between career and family life? For younger participants, this is a new question. You know, we've been dealing with it all of our lives, but it keeps on coming up. And my short answer is, let's don't expect us to have it all at once. I mean, who has love and money, fame and sleep, the ideal body mass and, you know, muscle index, and the time to send thank you notes? I mean, nobody. So I say what's important is having what matters. And having what matters changes from stage to stage of our lives. And actually, in later stages, we have to learn how to do with not having it all, having less, because we lose people, we lose jobs, we may lose financial security, and we have to live those years too. So it's a changing perspective. And I've thought a lot about these kinds of questions in the last few years because I was writing a memoir called Daring, My Passages. And it sometimes felt like seeing an old movie about the best moments of my life. And other times it felt like wisdom teeth extraction. Very difficult. So let me tee up our conversation by asking a few questions of you. How many of you have been steadfastly pursuing a career since finishing school, and you never did switch to the mommy track for any significant time? Well, I'd say that's about half. That's about half. That's huge. So how many of you took a significant time out to start a family? One, two, three. That's why you're where you are. So how many of you have the model egalitarian marriage with a spouse who shares the child care and the household responsibilities without excessive cursing? Well, that's about half. That's great. Okay, big improvement. What matters, I try to break it down by stages. So just a quick overview, and then I want to hear what you think about what matters where you are. What matters in the trying 20s is, of course, to find your identity and to stick with it despite parental objections or societal pressures to conform to the, you know, some should. And, of course, the shoulds in my generation were you should get married before you finish college, God forbid. You shouldn't have a ring by the time you get the diploma. And you should have your children in your 20s. And you should be a helpmeet to your husband who was going to be the successful breadwinner until the divorce. And then, so also what matters in the trying 20s, of course, as all the literature says, is finding a mentor and appealing for his or her coaching by offering what you can give back. And that's the other side of it, because, you know, mentors aren't are free for the mentor, but they have a lot of work to do. They're very important. And so what I found is you make it known what you can do for the mentor, and you can really do things. I'll tell a little story about me. My first big dare was when I was sequestered in the women's department of the New York Herald Tribune in the 1960s as a writer. All women had to be in the women's department. You couldn't cross over into the city room. That was the testosterone zone. It was only for people who wore white shirts and ties. So I snuck down the back stairs of the Herald Tribune, four floors, so my editor wouldn't catch me, and walked across the city room, invaded the city room, saw Tom Wolfe. I just asked him in the elevator, you know, what's it like writing for Clay Felker, who was changing journalism at that time? He said, well, the Herald Tribune is the main Tijuana bullring for competitive male feature writers, but you have to be brave. And I thought, well, okay, so I'm little, but I like to think I'm brave. So I just kept on walking, got to the door. Clay Felker, who was incubating New York Magazine inside the pages of the New York Herald Tribune, and all I heard was this huge voice and say, what do you mean you don't have my reservation? Clay Felker, the pool room, isn't this the Four Seasons? My usual table, I'm bringing a senator tonight, my wife's opening on Broadway. Thank you. I'm going to pitch a story to this man who knows everybody in New York. I said, Mr. Felker, he said, where did you come from? The estrogen zone. He laughed. He said, what have you got for me? So I have 30 seconds to pitch him a story and keep his attention, like trying not to get tongue-tied. And I said, well, it's about dorky guys who are, they have a beach house on Fire Island, and they're having specimen viewing parties to pick beautiful women to sit on their beach blanket to attract other beautiful women. And, you know, like flypaper. And he said, did you go to a specimen viewing party? Yes, they rejected me. Great, then write it just like you told it to me. Write it as a scene. We'll call it the flypaper people. He said, write journalism as a scene? This had always been just who, what, when, where, why. Now, suddenly, they were beginning to use the techniques of fiction. Character, scene setting, dialogue. Immersing yourself in the situation. So I took the leap. And I became part of that little band of, you know, writers, Tom Wolfe, Gloria Steinem, all kinds of wonderful writers who were doing new journalism, which ultimately became mainstream. And I wouldn't have done that if I didn't take that walk and invade the testosterone zone. So, and I had something to give. Fortunately, I was allowed to try. And then the second time that happened was a year later when Clay launched New York Magazine as a standalone publication for the first time. It was a big party at the Four Seasons. He came barging into my apartment late at night. My lookout on the fourth floor, I lived down on the Lower East Side on East 7th Street. He came in a limousine. We didn't have limousines on East 7th Street. And my lookout, a Ukrainian seamstress, called up and said, a fancy man van's coming up. It's okay? All right. So he comes in. He says, where were you at the party? I said, well, I mean, I don't have a gown, and I have a 2.5-year-old child, and I don't have a babysitter. He said, well, what do you know about politics? I said, well, my mother's a born rebel, Irish rebel, bomb-throwing Irish rebel. My father's a country club Republican. So what I know about politics, it's about fighting at the dinner table. He said, great. Then you'll understand Bobby. Bobby who? Bobby Kennedy, I want you to go out and cover his presidential campaign against Gene McCarthy in California and Oregon. Me? I've never written a political story. Now's the time to start. But babysit. She said, Gail, look, if you want to make your name as a journalist, don't keep writing all these nice little stories. No matter how interesting they are, they're not going to keep people's attention. What you have to do is tackle a big story, something everybody's talking about, but they don't know the why. That was the best career advice I ever had in my life, and I think it applies to many other fields. Jump into something you don't know anything about, but become knowledgeable about it. Claim it as yours. So I went on the trip, and I'm just going to cut to the chase. We're one trip, Bobby Kennedy is going up and down this yo-yo trip up and down the Cascade Mountains through terrible storms, tiny little aircraft. None of the senior reporters wanted to go, so I got a seat. So I'm sitting next to Bobby Kennedy, and all of a sudden as we're landing one place, this plane is coming straight at us. We can't see it. But suddenly we do see it. Our plane drops like a stone. Men are screaming. My stomach turns over. And Bobby Kennedy, in the middle of the drop, says, I knew Gene McCarthy was desperate. I didn't know he was that desperate. Well, that gave me an insight into Bobby Kennedy. He was such a fatalist because he'd seen so much death in his family. And that helped me to write about him because the very next night, his own life was ended at the point of a gun. So, again, taking that risk, jumping in when you don't have any idea what you're doing, and doing it for a mentor who was then going to, even if you stumble, the very fact that you took the chance may, you know, inculcate in your mentor the desire to continue to help you. So what matters in the turbulent 30s is to think out if and when you want a family. And, you know, so many women are not doing this today. You probably know the shocking statistic that 41% of women under 30 today are having a child with no committed partner. I was a single mom as a result of divorce. This is not a very good road. It's especially not very good for the child. So I just pray that we will get out of this this very damaging to the society way of going about things. So usually people who have education and who've lived in this world for the last 20 years understand that holding off until the late 20s or early 30s to have a child is a way to also have a career. But then how many children can you care for in a lean-in career? That's another thing I think that really bears a lot of thought. More than two is asking for 10 or 15 years of home labor in addition to your job, right? More than three requires a Marissa Mayer nursery. More than four, probably Catholic. More than five, it probably took multiple births, so it's a litter. And as my mentor, Margaret Mead, said, humans aren't supposed to have litters because, and then just 1 2-year-old, and we were just hearing this from our van driver last night, just 1 2-year-old is enough to prevent many women from continuing to work because they can't afford to pay $500 a week for a surrogate mom. And I think this is one of the biggest social issues that we must rally to change. We're all right on the edge to do this, paid maternity and paid paternity leave. We need to sell this not as an entitlement for poor adults. We need to sell it as an entitlement for children. Children need somebody there on a consistent basis, or two people there on a consistent basis. And 3 months is just the point at which a child is really attaching to the parent. And then suddenly that wonderful attachment is not there. Think how painful that is for the child. So we have to really fight for this. And of course, President Obama did make it a big point in his State of the Union speech, but we all have to get behind it and make it happen. So it's critical to build the social supports before children. If it's not going to be marriage, then you have to arrange with a family member to be your surrogate. I did that with my sister, who was much younger than I, and I'd helped her out of drug problems, and she came to stay with my daughter when I had to travel for writing. And compensate him or her. or negotiate with a spouse, because if you're the primary breadwinner, and I hear this more and more, make an arrangement, you know, for reciprocity at a later stage. Well, I'm telling you all these things as if, you know, you didn't know, and I didn't know in the 60s because, as you know, what the social instructions were. So I didn't wait until my 30s to have a family. I was married at 23, which I thought was very avant-garde because it wasn't 21. And I was a mother at 24 and blindsided by divorce at 28. So I found myself struggling, like so many young women I meet today, in the same way, to strike a balance between my personal life, need to make a living as a sole support, and my career aspirations. I wanted to be a writer. I'd always wanted to be a writer since I was 7 years old. So I had to scramble to pay the rent by working full time. But to be present for my toddler, I had to give up my job at the newspaper and had to think, can I really afford to be a freelance writer in my 20s? But I knew if I gave up that dream and went to work at Macy's, that fragile creative spark would probably fizzle out. And so that's when I went to work for as a freelance writer from home for New York Magazine and continued a career that became more and more exciting. But I know, having been a single mom for 15 years, today many women I meet say at 30, 35 becomes like a premature midlife crisis for a lot of women who say, I've been so focused on gaining the economic security and the prestige of a important career, I forgot to get married. I forgot to have a child. When am I going to do these things? Well, I'm very efficient. I'll get this all on the road in a year. I heard that from Lisa Lambert, you know. I'll get this, you know, we'll make this happen in a year. Well, it took 3 years. So, it worked out. She found the right man. She found the right time. And I think at 40 or 41, she had a child, 40, and then she had a second child. But she wasn't going to have three, which is what she had wanted. These are the trade-offs. And then I find another thing happening among women in their flourishing 40s today, which is a wonderful decade, great acceleration in every area. But often professional women are wrestling with teenage children at this stage. And maybe they've had a late baby, you know, before the egg machine loses power. So they have a little one, and they have a 12 or 14 or 16-year-old you know, kind of treats mom, shows about as much respect for her as a male boss in a tech company. I mean, you know, you just don't know what you're talking about, mom. Come on, you know, please. Oh, great, you have a social media campaign. And so the professional woman if she decides to stay home to, you know, deal with trying to keep her daughter from sexting all the time and maybe taking care of the infant, and she's really doing the right thing by, you know, leaning in as a mom, she begins to lose her identity and her sanity. I just talked to one of these women last night. So what does she do? She said, I have to go back to work to get away from my children. So she just took a big job at a big company that was some international travel because it's better than having all this friction at home. So then we get to the flaming 50s. I call it the flaming 50s for obvious reasons. There's a certain heat that comes to your face. But it's also a time when it's really a fiery time. It's the springboard into our second adulthood. You know, today, even the American Psychological Association says what I've been saying for some time, which is adolescence lasts until 28 today for Americans. So then you have 28 to 50 is our first adulthood. Then you have 50 till, well, 92 if you don't have heart disease or cancer as a woman. So it's much longer than our first adulthood. Much longer. Lots of stuff to plan and prepare for. Kids are out of the house. You're feeling creative, ready to pursue your passion. And as I've written in a book called Sex and the Seasoned Woman, a lot of women are ready to pursue their sexual passion, to recover that side of themselves. And then out of the blue, maybe, you get the call. Your mother's had a bad fall, or your dad has run a red light and hit somebody, but he doesn't quite remember how it happened. And you don't know whether it's his eyes or maybe it's his mind. And he isn't going to give you the keys. So you begin to have another job, family caregiver. And that often, you know, connects while you still have an adolescent child at home and you have the most responsibilities you've ever had in your career. I've written a book about that, too, called Passages in Caregiving, because I went through that for 17 years with my husband. But it's, you know, the secret there is before the crisis to have a family meeting with your siblings and any other family members you can. Not like at Christmas or Thanksgiving, but over, say, maybe a holiday weekend. Get everybody together, have a nice time, and then talk about what happens when mom or dad begins to need us. What can each of us bring to the table? And kind of get those assignments talked out before it happens. So it doesn't all fall on the daughter who lives closest to mom and may eventually have to give up her career if she becomes a sole caregiver. So then I just want to mention some good news about I just wrote a book, not a book, an article for The Atlantic called, about the tech industry and diversity called, Straight White Men Don't Have All the Great Ideas. And it's about all the spigots that are promoting, tech training for girls from age 7 all the way up through graduate school and how they're all ready to pump into the new tech, diverse tech talent pipeline. And then, of course, Intel has really given it the imprimatur by putting $300 million on the table for training and retaining women and minorities in tech. And as I was talking to Roz Hadnill, the diversity officer of Intel last night, and Renee James, the president, they said they're rewarding managers not just for hiring women and minorities, but for retaining, hiring and holding. And that means really retraining a whole male-dominant culture. And so the fact that they're doing it and calling on other companies to follow suit and help them is very, very positive. So I'll leave you with that. Do you want to respond to anything I've said? Talk about what's important at your stage of life? Shy. Well, think about, if you're at the, mid-senior level and you think about moving up to a top level, what kind of trade-offs do you have to think about? So many women at that point leave and start their own companies or their own consulting businesses because they see what top management has to put in, so many hours. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, as you said a lot, so I'm reflecting on that, so I'm not sure if it's a question or maybe a statement, but maybe a dialogue. So your passages and what you're talking about has transcended time.
Yes.
But do you think that in the world we're living in today, again, I don't have an answer, or maybe it's just a dialogue, is social media and what's happening with connections, with the internet, and how we're living today, is that going to change passages? Right? Because people, kids today, and the next generation that's coming up is in a world that's much more connected, that's networked, that's mobile, that doesn't have to be in the office,
right,
that has an opportunity to meet 55,000 men at one time instead of just the one that's, in your college.
Right.
Is that going to change the passages?
I think what it changes more than anything else is it destroys our attention span. And adds a lot of stress because it's very difficult to concentrate and do deep thinking work. But as far as I find that, young people in their 20s, and I have some working for me, they still suffer from imposter syndrome, which is common even to men, not as much so, but, you get hired, you get given new responsibilities, things you haven't done before. You don't have a degree for it. You haven't done it before. So often women feel like, what's going to happen when they find out I don't know all they think I know? Well, you don't let them know. You just keep learning and asking questions. One of the people at the table said people thought that she was the smartest one, smartest new hire because she kept her mouth shut and she just asked questions. She made the senior people feel really smart. And meanwhile, she learned, and she didn't show what she didn't know. So I think that continues. It takes longer now to get the schooling that you need. We take much longer to grow up, and we take much longer to grow old. That has happened, and it's 10 years, maybe 15 years delayed all the way through. That's already happened. And then usually around late 20s, early 30s, you have developed some competence and confidence in what you know how to do, and you know more people, and especially, as you say now, your connections around the world. So you become dissatisfied with what you've just been doing, even though it may have been perfectly appropriate to that stage. I just call that the catch-30 passage. People then sometimes tear up the career they've had and go in a different direction, or at least they make many modifications. And it's also a trying time about relationships, because you had a number of relationships, and now you really want to either settle down or you don't want to have anything to do with them for a while. You're just going to go straight towards the career. So, the issues change, and the time frame moves ahead. But there's still, it's all about adult development. And just because we have social media doesn't mean we get mature when we're 19.
Actually, it seems like in some ways, don't you think that they're stunted in terms of their personal development? You have aging.
Yes.
Longer, but also skill sets. Social media in some ways is changing the way people are.
Well, I agree. That's a very good point. And especially that's why, it isn't as if women don't have control over the means of production. We do. So why are 41% of them having children in their 20s without a committed partner when we know that's not a very easy road to hoe? And if they say it's accidental, well, whose accident was it? And, you know, just having, you know, somebody who's like a 2-year sleepover is not a committed partner. And often the man involved just doesn't feel any responsibility because if she didn't want to have a child, why didn't she protect it, you know? So I do think that there's a lot less clarity. There's just so few boundaries that nobody knows where they are. And I think that's kind of there's a downside to that. Yes.
What do you think about the passage? Perhaps what you said to what's real. I mean, I think we're defining what's real differently today than we used to, and I wonder what's
real. You mean like?
Well, connectedness. I think in, you know, before the internet did involve some level of commitment.
Right.
There was a physical manifestation that you had to put into a relationship.
Right.
So in some ways, when you think about women having children without a partner,
right,
we're doing a lot of the same things. We have a lot of the same things today in society of things that perhaps don't replace the real underpinnings.
Right. I know. Yeah, just, you know, moving from left to right on your iPhone or texting is not a relationship. You actually have to have physical contact and mental contact and spiritual contact. So, that's very worrisome. But I think eventually people really long for, you know, a human who interacts with you in a way that, you know, it forms a third entity, you know, and they'll see that among some of their peers who get married and seem to be thriving. So I don't think all is lost, but it's easy to get, you know, not to get the experience in one area of adult development that Eric Erickson pointed out was primary in the 20s, which is develop the capacity for intimacy. Okay, intimacy is a big word, but we know it means many different layers. And you have to be living with or close to somebody over a long period of time for that intimacy to develop. For both people to begin to trust, you'd still love me if, right? I remember when my husband first, the second time he got cancer, he had it 4 times over the course of 17 years, we went to see a cancer psychologist, and it came out that he thought that I would leave him because he was not going to be the same man that he was. And we'd been together for like 30 years. And it was shocking to me that he would even have that doubt. So it takes a long time for intimacy to really kick in. Thanks. Oh.
The reflection I've had, actually, we talk a lot about this.
Right.
The men, they are as scared as we are. Let's face it, wherever we go, they are as unsure, as scared, as insecure. I think I'd love for us to, I have a daughter, and I think a lot of them have kids, and we go through this. One is our passage, another one is how do we get a kiss?
I've
got to get in that courage, not only because I'm a girl, but I'm a human being. How do I develop myself in this world and build my courage? We all learn different ways.
Right.
We all have our fear. It doesn't really help that much to promote a girl. You have this fear, you have to protect yourself. And the guys, you know, they can just, you know, get a 2 nights or 2 years, they walk away.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily in my mind what majority of the people, no matter how they connect, either from physical connection or Facebook connection, I don't believe that's the desire of this society.
Mm-hmm.
I think the desire of the society is still the real connection, the real value.
Mm-hmm.
still believe in that and have been brainwashed to, and I will personally continue to drive for that, to encourage and use that much. Then the vehicle, the way you connect becomes just part of the way we do things. Kids, they do connect completely different than the way we old people did when we were at their age. It is what it is, but it doesn't necessarily need to change the real value. And I think that's for both men and women, boys and girls. If we can start to show the men we think are irresponsible or, the reason and party who screwed up the whole day, we can start to bring them in and show the real skill, the value, the right thing we all desire to have. I think we have to make it better for ourselves, for our kids, and for the whole environment.
Well, I think modeling for children is really one of the great tasks we have. And if we have an intact marriage and children see the daily exchange of responsibilities, joys, disappointments, that's the best role model they can have. But I want to just say that in terms of showing, developing courage, there was only one, in writing Daring, my passages, what I found out that the way I learned, I'm a normally fearful person, the way I learned to move ahead was when I fear, I dare. That's when I take the leap. And sure, I often fall on my face or just stumble, but I learn something from it. I grow from it. I didn't die from it. And often I made a connection out of it, or I showed that I was ready to take a jump, and that helps. And there was one study I found in Scandinavia that talked about how adolescents came out feeling more confident as opposed to those who were much more risk averse. And it was because their parents gave them access to knives and scissors when they were like 3 years old and taught them how to use them. So they mastered that. I can master these implements. And then later fire and water, playing near fire and water. And then also letting them play in woods unsupervised for several hours. So you skin your knee. So, maybe you break an arm. Boys chase you. You get away. I mean, you learn so much. And then you fight back. Right. So, so I think those kinds of experiences can be drawn on when young people have to go into the work world and say, well, this isn't as scary as I thought. I can fake this and probably I can make it next time. So thanks.
Thank you. So hopefully that gives you a bit of inspiration for what you're going to experience for the rest of the day, and greatly appreciate your comments this morning, Gail, and the dialogue from everyone in the room. So thank you for being with us this morning. The conference starts in about 15 minutes, and it's open seating down in the main auditorium on the main level. On your badge is a table number. This is for lunch. And so we have assigned seating at these tables for lunch. There are four tables for the Corn Ferry group towards the front of the auditorium, and it's at 1 o'clock, and this is where you'll hear from Hillary Clinton and Brene Brown and a couple of the other dignitaries. So just be sure and look at your table number for the lunch, but everything else is open seating. At 3 o'clock today, we are running a session. Jane Stevenson is here from our CEO and board practice. And we are doing a session about women on boards. And so if you have an interest in getting a board seat or learning what it's like to be a woman on a board in today's age, this would be a great session to come to. The logistics are all in the program materials in the books that you have, in the folders you have. And the final thing I'll mention on the tables is the latest book by Robin Roberts, and that also is a gift for you to take with you as well. So with that, we'll let you get on your way. If you have any questions at all during the day, you can email me or phone me at 415-272-4242, and I will try and help you if you run into any issues during the day. But it's 415-272-4242. But greatly appreciate you making the time for the breakfast, and thank you for being our guest today, and we hope you enjoy the day. We'll see you at lunch. Thank you.